and Elio behind, waving the golden vest. Sometimes they were close behind the Sempertern. Sometimes the Sempertern was pulting about on his own, roaring for the mitre, or the esemplastic staff, or the ermine buskins. Each time he appeared, a giggle rose into Vivian's throat, and she had to dodge through the nearest door to laugh. That was how she found the Emporic mitre in the end. The last room she dodged into turned out to be a bathroom. At least, Vivian gathered it was a bathroom, from the wet prints of the Sempertern's feet on the cork floor. But she had never, in her part of the 20th century, come across anything like the huge glass bath that stood halfway to the ceiling, full of green water bubbling like a cauldron. Her eye caught something like a golden drainpipe on the other side of the glass bath, and she thought at first that it was just a golden drainpipe. Luckily, she was so amazed by the bath that she walked all round it, and there was the hat, lying on the damp floor. Vivian picked it up and joined in the chase, waving the hat and shouting to Sempertern Walker that she had found it. But he just scudded on in front and took no notice at all. After they had all raced up to the attics, and then down once more, and seemed about to set off to the attics again, Vivian had the giggles so badly that she had no breath left at all. So she did the obvious thing, and waited in the hall until they all came tearing down again. Sempertern Walker appeared first, speeding downstairs towards her with one ermine busking flapping off his leg and the other in his hand. "Where is that Emporic mitre?" he roared. Vivian took a deep breath to stop herself laughing.
"Here!"
she shrieked, and held on to the rest of the breath to keep the giggle down. But it did no good. As she jammed the hat into the Sempertern's free hand, the laugh came out. She more or less hooted in his face. Then she had to bend over with tears running down her cheeks.
"Oh," she said, "you are so funny."
Sempertern Walker stood completely still and gave her his most anguished look ever. While he stood there, staring, Petula raced down the stairs and handed him the esemplastic staff. Elio burst through the other people, straggling downstairs after her, and flung the golden vest thing round his shoulders.
"The Emporic cope, sir," he said.
He was the only one not out of breath. Sempertern Walker turned his anguished stare on Elio. Then he gave the rest of the stragglers a deeply hurt look all round, and stalked off to his study with his buskin flapping. Everyone soberly followed him, carrying their pieces of regalia. Vivian was feeling exactly the same as when she had said the wrong thing to the guardian that morning.
"You shouldn't have laughed, miss," Elio explained seriously, before he followed the others. "Not to his face, that is. The Sempertern, like all born humans, needs excitement, and his work is very boring. I usually take care to mislay at least one garment before every ceremony."
Vivian felt more like crying than laughing.
"Will he forgive me?"
"I do not know," said Elio. "No one has dared to laugh at him before."
Vivian went and sat in the matutinal, feeling ashamed, until the palace went quiet. Then she went into the hall. Just as she expected, Jonathan was coming carelessly downstairs, looking as if it was the merest accident that had happened to reappear the moment the fuss was over.
"Let's go and see the ceremony,"
Vivian said to him. She felt she owed it to Sempertern Walker.
"Do you want to?"
Jonathan said, much surprised. It'll be horribly boring. But he obligingly went with her to Aeon Square, where they packed in amongst rows of tourists near the glass arcade. They were in time to watch a smart squad of time patrollers march out of the patrol building and take up a position near Faber John Stone. People in red robes and white and blue filed out of other buildings and archways and stood in position too. Then came processions. Vivian saw Jenny, now wrapped in a wide mauve cloak, among a whole lot of people, all walking with small steps because of the tight robe underneath. She saw Mr. Enkian, marching importantly at the head of a line of blue-robed librarians. There was a group of students in dusty green gowns. Everybody seemed to be taking part. Even Dr. Willander was there, bulking in a shabby purple robe. Vivian saw why he spent so much of his time sitting in Seldom End. He walked with quite a limp. She watched Jonathan's father pace slowly past, stately and golden, with a tall pipe-shaped hat towering on his head.
"What is this ceremony about?" she asked.
"No idea," said Jonathan.
"Then you should know,"
said a severe man next to them. He was an obvious tourist in respectable blue and yellow check drapes. He folded his information sheet over and held it in front of Jonathan.
"It's the first of the four ceremonies of the founding of the city. It's very old. It goes right back to the beginning. And it's said to mark the first moments when Time City was separated from history. You should be proud to witness it, my boy. We've come specially to see it."
He took back the information sheet and said anxiously,
"And it says the forecast rain will hold off until the ceremony's over. I hope it's right."
So the city really had arrived back to the time when it was founded, Vivian thought. She felt unexpectedly anxious. Another procession was winding its way in from Secular Square. This one seemed to be of ordinary people, all dressed in sober, pale pyjamas, each with a chain of some kind hung around his or her neck. The sun twinkled on the chains and flashed on the buckles and shiny boots of the time patrollers. Jonathan's father flared gold in the midst of all the bright coloured robes. There seemed no sign of the rain the tourist had talked about. But it was coming, hanging over the ceremony just like the end of things seemed to be hanging over Time City. What will happen to all these people, Vivian thought, if Time City just collapses? Jonathan must have been thinking the same thing.
"I don't want all this to go," he said.
"It won't. We're going to do something about it," Vivian said. "The Guardian called us in."
But the ceremony did go on, rather. Sam found them and stood for 5 minutes with them, watching, after which he yawned loudly and went away. Vivian felt it would be a bit rude to go away too, after what the tourist had said, so she kept herself amused by pressing the studs of her belt. Time function. They had already been watching for more than an hour. Pen function, weather report, rain due in 2 minutes. Low weight function, at which the severe tourist gave her a very reproving look. And finally, credit function. Her palm lit up. 0.00. Vivian stared at it. She pressed the stud again. And yet again, to bring the numbers back. It still said 0.00.
"Jonathan, what's wrong? This said 100 yesterday morning, and I haven't spent anything yet."
"Ask Elio. It must have a fault," Jonathan said. "And just look over there."
Vivian looked where Jonathan nodded. All the important people had formed themselves into a new procession, with Mr. Enkin stalking proudly at its head. Dr. Leonov, the high scientist, was walking behind Mr. Enkin, beside the huge purple bulk of Dr. Willander. And the poor, crazy Iron Guardian had joined the procession too. His floppy hat was bobbing, and his face was very serious, and he was imitating Mr. Enkin's important walk exactly. Probably he thought that was the right way to walk. Dr. Leonov glanced at him once, doubtfully, and then seemed to decide he was a time ghost or another student joke. Dr. Willander must have decided the same, because he took no notice of the Guardian at all, and simply limped grimly on with his eyes fixed on Mr. Enkian's strutting back. Quite a number of people had seen. A wave of amused murmuring swept down that side of the square. But Mr. Enkian was far too wrapped up in his own importance to notice. Then the rain came down in white sheets. Vivian was glad of the excuse to go. The severe tourist and his wife raised a small blue and yellow tent above their heads and stayed to watch. But Vivian and Jonathan ran for time close, with umbrellas of all possible shapes and sizes going up around them. Elio had been watching the ceremony too. They met him under the archway, while they were pushing through the crowd of damp people sheltering there. By this time rain was battering on the cobbles of Time Close, and gargling in every groove of the buildings. The three of them dashed for the Anuit Palace together. There, as they stood dripping on the patterned marble floor, Vivian seized the chance to tell Elio about the credit on her belt. Elio asked to look at it. Vivian took off the heavy, wet leather and passed it over. Elio's straight, pale hair dripped on it as he ran the belt between his fingers. He looked annoyed with himself.
"I weighed the odds," he said, "and decided against having a rain shield function on any of our belts. My calculation was that we would be outside in only 2% of the year's rainfall. What I forgot is that 2% is as wet as any other rain.
No, this belt is in perfect working order. The fault must be in the city computer." He passed Vivian the belt back.
"I will check the computer tomorrow," he said.
"Just now,
I shall be busy. The Sempiterne is going to be very wet and very cross when he comes in."
But Vivian discovered what was wrong with her belt next morning, long before Elio did. It was a moist blue after-rain morning. She and Jonathan set off for school and found that Sam was not waiting at the fountain as usual. Vivian thought she saw him lurking under the archway, but Jonathan said quickly,
"No, that'll be Leon. I asked him to meet me there if he'd found out anything. You go over and ask about Sam, it's that house there, while I talk to Leon."
And he went racing off to the archway, pigtail flying, obviously very excited. Vivian thought, as she went towards the rosy brick house Jonathan had pointed out. "I think Jonathan doesn't want me to know what he says to Leon Hardy. I wonder why." She stood and looked at the front door of the Donegals' house. There was no knocker and no bell, but there must have been some other device. While Vivian was standing there, wondering what to do, the door opened, and Sam's father came out, pulling the pajama top of his uniform down through his belt, obviously ready to leave for work.
"Morning," he said. "I waited for you. It's no good calling for Sam. He won't get to duration today. He's had another butter pie orgy and made himself sick as a suicide, I'm afraid."
As soon as Sam's father said that,
Vivian knew what had gone wrong with her belt.
Oh,
she said.
Thank you.
And she turned to go back to the archway, but Mr. Donegal shut his front door and stepped out beside her in the most friendly possible way. This made Vivian feel very awkward. For one thing, she was very angry with Sam. For another, she wanted to hear what Leon Hardy was telling Jonathan. And on top of all this, she found she was rather shy of Sam's father. He had a fierce, active feel about him, which he had not met in the other people of Time City. She was sure this was the feeling you got from someone with a lot of power, who gave orders and got obeyed, and that was alarming in itself. But she remembered that Mr. Donegal was supposed to be her uncle, and did her best to give him a niece-like smile.
"I thought Sam didn't have any credit," she said.
"Oh, he hasn't. He went into patrol building during the ceremony last night and tinkered with my computer outlet," said Mr. Donegal. "Got it to give him a credit strip from someone else's account. Cunning little devil."
He sounded stern, but Vivian could tell he was secretly rather proud of Sam.
"He won't say whose account it was. Can't get it out of him."
"But I know," Vivian thought. "Just because he was annoyed that Jonathan and I are going off without him, and we haven't even gone yet." She was angrier than ever with Sam. But she did not say anything to Mr. Donegal, because she wanted to be revenged on Sam for herself.
"How many did he eat?" she asked.
100 units worth. Would you believe that?" Mr. Donegal said.
Vivian did believe it. It was the final proof. She would have liked to tell Jonathan, who was standing under the archway talking to Leon Hardy. But frustratingly, both of them looked round, saw Vivian and Mr. Donegal walking across Time Close, and set off out into Eon Square, talking hard all the time.
"I was wanting to speak to you," said Mr. Donegal, "about 20th Century."
"Yes?"
Vivian said nervously.
"It's gone critical, all right," said Mr. Donegal. "World War I is affected now. It runs right back into a thing called the Boer War. War II starts in 1937 at the moment. It's getting pretty nasty out there, I won't lie to you. But I don't want you to worry, either."
"But I do," Vivian thought, as they went into the shadow of the archway. She forgot about Sam, and about Jonathan and Leon Hardy. All she could think was, what about Mum and Dad? They came out into the brightness of Eon Square, where Jonathan and Leon were small shapes out beyond Faber John Stone.
"Your mother and father are quite safe,"
Mr. Donegal said. It was just as if he could read Vivian's thoughts. Except he was talking about the wrong mother and father.
"Observers are given plenty of protection, and Time Patrol keeps going in and checking. I won't deny that I was a little annoyed with your father for being so slow to report the deterioration, but that doesn't mean I'm neglecting him or Inga. I'm putting a zero-hour request to Chronolog to recall all the observers from that era. I thought you'd want to know that. Chronolog will do it, but they'll be a bit slow because of all these foundation ceremonies. Couldn't have happened at a worse time for us. But not to worry. You'll have your father and mother back safe in Time City in 3 or 4 days at the most."
Thanks,
Vivian managed to say. They walked on towards Faber John Stone. Mr. Donegal went on talking. Vivian dimly heard him say that Time Patrol had still not caught the cause of all the trouble, and she rather thought he went on to say that the second and third unstable eras were in a mess too. But she did not attend to any of it. When at last he patted her cheerily on the shoulder and went off the patrol building at a rolling trot just like Sam's, Vivian's legs were almost refusing to move her. Jonathan was at the doorway of duration by then. Vivian saw Leon wave to him and stride off along the bottom of the square past a line of children hurrying towards duration. With a great effort, she managed to cross the rest of the square at a weak run. She was almost too alarmed to think straight. In 3 or 4 days, the Lees would be back, and the real cousin Vivian would be with them. Somehow she had never really thought of that happening, and that was quite stupid of her. Jenny had talked about observers being recalled days ago.
"I've been living," Vivian panted to herself, "in, what does Mum call it? A fool's paradise. That's what I've been. A fool in paradise. How daft!"
She was glad of school to take her mind off it. Even though the morning's lessons did not seem so lively without Sam making a noise every few minutes. But at least universal symbols were something to think about beside the Lees. She almost looked forward to Dr. Willander that afternoon, because he made it really very difficult to think of anything else at all. Then halfway through the morning, the message stud flashed on Vivian's belt. She was quite pleased with herself for noticing, considering what was on her mind. She pressed the stud, and the empty space of her desk shone with the words, "Hakon Willander, to V. Lee. Sorry, forgot beastly ceremony this afternoon. See you tomorrow instead." Oh, bother, Vivian thought. Now I've got a whole afternoon with nothing to do but worry. But as soon as she went into the lunchroom, Jonathan grabbed her arm.
"Get some food and come back to the palace," he whispered. "Leon's going to meet us in 101 Century."
Vivian looked at him and realized he was wearing the suit with diamonds. She looked down at herself. Her suit was a brownish-orange with small white stripes, which had not shown up very well in the darkness of the passage. But she recognized it now, as the suit her ghost had been wearing. And Sam had made himself ill. "This is it," she thought excitedly. "I have to go and come back. Then, with any luck, I can leave before the real Vivian Lee gets here." Chapter 11. The Age of Gold. Jonathan rushed straight off, but Vivian treated herself to 4 butter pies before she left. Her only regret was that she might not have time to get her revenge on Sam. Otherwise, she walked across Sion Square, eating the last butter pie, full of pleasant thoughts. By tonight, she could be home. She saw herself telling Mum how awful Cousin Marty was, and she saw Mum being very understanding and letting her stay in Lewisham in spite of the bombs. She saw Dad coming home for the weekend and being really surprised. This wonderful daydream was enough to set her making little skips as she crossed the square. And when she got to Time Close, where there was no one about to see, she did a silly dance round the fountain, waving the stick of her butter pie.
"What kept you?"
said Jonathan. He was waiting by the chained door with the diamond-shaped pockets of his suit bulging. Vivian could see he was in a fever of impatience.
"Sorry,"
she said, not really meaning it.
The best thing about time travel, as Vivian had seen almost straight away, was that you could waste hours on the way and still arrive at the exact right time.
Why do we have to meet Leon Hardy in 101?
Jonathan hurried her down the passage.
He knows all about the Dark 90s, he said. He says we'll need protective equipment to go then, and he's going to get us some from the nearest fixed century he can get to. But of course he has to leave by an official time lock down the river. So he can't get to an unstable era himself, so he's going as close as he can. He's being awfully kind.
Jonathan stopped and gave the secret door an expert kick. It swung smoothly round. They squeezed in and pressed the light studs on their belts. The spiral stair did not seem either so endless or so frightening by now.
"Why are we going to the Dark 90s?"
Vivian asked as they scrambled down.
"It's one of the long, unstable eras,"
Jonathan called up.
"So it must be either the Age of Lead or the Age of Gold. I thought we'd find the Guardian and tell him to bring his polarity back to Time City before the thief gets it, like the Iron Guardian said."
This seemed a good idea to Vivian. In fact, she thought, as she slithered off the last step into the little room, where the slate still flickered and their 20th-century clothes lay where they had thrown them off, that she had told Jonathan they should do this a long time ago. Jonathan picked the egg-shaped control off its stone and installed it carefully in one of his pockets. His pockets chinked.
"What else have you brought?"
Vivian asked.
"Metal detector, map, compass, torch, emergency rations," Jonathan said. "I'm going to do this properly. Now, be quiet while I focus my mind on Leon."
He concentrated. Nothing happened.
"Leon Hardy," he said loudly. Still nothing happened. "Oh, no!"
Jonathan almost screamed.
"The control's run out."
"It can't have done," said Vivian. "We were coming back. I mean, our time ghosts were."
Jonathan took the egg out of his pocket again and held it in front of his face.
"Leon Hardy," he told it loudly and slowly. "The first year of 101 century.
That did the trick. The slate cleared into light that was so dim that they hardly realized that the egg had worked at all. A cold wind blew in at them, smelling strongly of sawdust and wet grass. Jonathan switched his belt light off and walked cautiously forward. As Vivian switched hers off and fumbled after him, she heard a blackbird sing, loud and clear from somewhere near. Funny that there are still blackbirds, she thought, looking round for Leon Hardy. If this is right at the other end of history, of course. It felt just like any dark morning anywhere. Leon Hardy was there, sitting on a fallen tree just behind them. As Vivian's eyes adjusted, she saw him get up, shivering and rubbing his arms. That little kilt he wore did not look very warm.
"You made it," he said in a low, cautious voice. "I was beginning to wonder if you'd get here before the people came to work. I've got the stuff. I've been sitting over it half the night. Let me help you get it on."
There was a heap of what looked like tree bark beside his feet.
Leon picked up a piece of it, and it proved to be the top half of a sort of suit of armour. There was too little light to see more than that it was dullish, with wrinkled places at the elbows and shoulders where it was supposed to bend. "Do we really need that?" Jonathan said.
"I'll say you will," said Leon. "There are gangs of wild men and wild dogs and time knows what all back there in the 90s. We still have trouble with them in this era."
He helped them fasten themselves into the armour, rather hurriedly, as if there was not much time. It was made of some tough, bendy stuff Vivian had never met before, and it was far heavier than she thought it should have been. The lower part was only for the front of their legs, Vivian